I'm Mike Gillis.
And I'm Casey Doran. And this is Radio versus the Martians. Oh, so I have a, this is totally orthogonal. Do you know what the actual song title is of the James Wetzel composed Podcast de la Vista theme song? Do you remember what it is?
Yeah, Surfing Mars.
No. That was the first version, I think. No, Surfing Mars is the Radio versus the Martians one he did. Yeah. I'm talking about his Podcast de la Vista one.
Oh,
Do you remember?
I've seen the file name.
So you are probably one of three people, being James Wetzel, you, and myself, who actually know what the full title of the Podcast La Vista theme song is. It's Total Predatory Coninator. That's the name of the song.
That is pretty great.
Trivia. It's only the Black Ops, only our Black Ops members will be able to have this bit of trivia in their hip pocket, waiting for Radio versus the Martians trivia night.
And so, soon. Now that we're talking to folks, I think this is probably a good opportunity to mention that we do have a vote going on our Patreon page, on patreon.com/radioversusthemartians. You guys should have all gotten an email about this.
Yeah.
It's a thing that I have been sort of insecure about because I don't, obviously we're not Serial. We're not, you know, How Did This Get Made or any of the really big podcasts out there that can charge a lot because, you are a wonderful, loyal, tiny crew of people that we love. And we don't want to stretch you too thin because I know that a majority of the people that support us on Patreon do it at the $1 level. And yeah, we love you all. I'd rather, again, maybe this is just Bernie Sanders math, but I'd rather have a bunch of people give us at a dollar than one person give us at a bunch of people at that level. You know, it's like, you know, I'd rather have more people.
Yeah, agreed.
So, I know that it's a big deal because we live in trying times. We live in awful times where watching the news is just, it does not feel good.
That and people don't make as much money as they used to relative to your parents at the same age. So whenever we say $1 a month, $12 a year, or if you happen to be an episode sponsor, thank you to our episode sponsors.
Yes.
$120 a month is nothing to sneeze at.
No. A year. Yeah, a year, yeah. I would not turn
$120 a month? Yes.
I mean, I'm not going to turn away $120 a month, but like I said, it's that Bernie Sanders small donor thing. I'd rather have more people support me with a tiny amount than one person like support you a lot, because then you feel kind of like, because it's a big deal. It's a big deal to spend, you know, $1 or $10 every month. So what we're kind of putting a vote to is, should we raise that minimum threshold? The Black Ops episode minimum threshold from $1 a month to $2 a month. And that's a big deal. And I don't want to do it casually. And I don't want to do this easily.
We're not Netflix, you know. We're not having to stave off bankruptcy and investors.
And right? Also,
the bank won't be broken if you say no and you still give us $1 a month. Like,
exactly.
We would be happy if you stayed giving us $1 a month.
Yeah, so, yeah. I mean, we don't want to do the Darth Vader, we're altering the deal, because it feels like when you signed up on Patreon to support
us. Which one of us is Lando in this situation?
I think we're both kind of trying to avoid being Lando. Lando had no choice, though. We want to make that clear.
That's true.
We do have a choice, and that's why we're giving that choice to you.
Yeah.
So we have put it on the Patreon page, and we're going to link it with this episode as well, that there's a vote, and the threshold for this vote passing is high.
Yeah.
And it's high for a reason, because we want to not scare a bunch of you away. We don't want to say, hey, you signed up for this deal to get an episode from us exclusive for $1 a month and then have us change that from under you. So it's got the threshold of being like a constitutional amendment.
Right.
So if you think that you have no objection for us raising this threshold from $1 a month to $2 a month, go on Radio versus the Martians Patreon page. That's patreon.com/Radio versus the Martians, and vote yes. And by voting yes, You're saying, hey, I have no problem with you raising that and going to $2 a month. And don't feel bad if you want to vote no.
Yeah.
Because I'd rather know. I'd rather know that this is a bad idea.
And I think the results so far, we haven't reached the threshold yet, when last I looked.
Yeah. So the threshold, like I said, constitutional amendment, is we need 2/3 of all of you to vote yes. So it's not just 2/3 of the vote. It's 2/3 of all of you.
Yeah.
So if... at this current time, there are 60 people who give to us on Patreon, who do support us on Patreon. That means we need 40 yes votes. Right now, there's 33 yes votes, so...
which is a hell of a lot of yes votes, and they're all unanimously yes right now.
Well, we've got one no, and I don't want to poo-poo on that
person. No, not at all.
I love that honesty. I want someone to know that that's a good idea, because I don't want to force this on people. So I want to know that it isn't just the people who are giving above... $1 voting yes, and all the people underneath it, because I don't want to lose all of those people voting at a dollar level.
Agreed.
So, please let us know what you think. I'd love if you all voted yes, but if you don't, let us know that, because I'd rather be told, no, we don't want this, and to just go with what you want than to try to force something on you and drive you away.
Yeah, and I think it's fair enough to say that both Mike and I understand that people's experience of having podcasts, of listening to podcasts, is most podcasts are free of charge, and a lot of them do what we do, right, which is we give some exclusives as a way to incentivize people to support our show, and we're never going to lock down our catalog behind a paywall. We're never going to make it so the main panel episodes and the main shows that we do are going to be blocked if you don't donate to us. But I mean, the thing is that we will have these Black Ops episodes and in the near future, some exclusive episodes about upcoming shows that we are going to do. And I guess eventually I'd like there to be some kind of incentive involved, some future live shows that we're going to do.
Yeah.
TBD on that.
Mm-hmm.
More information on that later. But yeah, I think we know how much we love even that people listen to us, even if they don't pay us any money at all. I would much rather think that I made someone's day, having a stressful day driving home from work or driving to work, and made their day a little bit easier than I would taking $2 a month out of their pocket, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's the thing, is that we do respect that you give to us, and we know that that's a lot. I mean, I give on Patreon, and I know how much even little amounts do add up, and by buying support for us, you're not buying something else. And
right.
So please go to patreon.com/radioversusthemartians and let us know what you think of that vote, because we really want to know. We want to know if we should move forward with this. I'd like you to vote yes, but if you feel no, please vote no without judgment, because I'd rather know how people feel about that than try to force things, because then it has the same net result as I don't want to turn people off.
Agreed. Okay, now that we've got that out of the way, Henry Cavill as The Witcher.
I like Henry Cavill, period. I think that I haven't watched the trailer for
yet. Okay.
I have very limited experience with Witcher as a franchise. I have Witcher 3 that you got for me.
Mm-hmm.
I played just probably about 5 hours of it. I really want to get back to it and play that again,
mm-hmm.
especially now that I'm winding down Red Dead Redemption 2.
Oh, winding down.
Oh my God, it's amazing. Let's talk about that in a little bit. But
I'm so jealous it's not on PC yet, so...
Yeah, I hope it is. I want more people to play it.
I think it will be. They did this with Grand Theft Auto V. They dangled it for months and months and months, and then eventually they released it when they wanted to get people to double dip, I think is what they wanted to do, but yeah.
So, Witcher's not a franchise I'm super familiar with, and from playing what I did of the game, I like Henry Cavill. I think Henry Cavill is one of those guys that... I guess I put him in the same category as Idris Elba, where I think he's got a great screen presence, he's got a lot of charisma, and there's just something in other people's decisions that are holding him back.
Maybe, yeah.
For instance, with Superman, I think he's an amazing Superman when they let him be Superman, and he's great in the Mission Impossible movie that he's in.
I thought that was the one that stood out. I didn't see the Guy Ritchie
Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Man from U.N.C.L.E.
That one's great.
Yeah, I really want to see
it. And when you see like Man from U.N.C.L.E. and other things, you really...
I don't, however, want to see a Guy Ritchie Aladdin live action remake.
Who doesn't
make any fucking sense.
I just want to throw this out there to Disney. Apparently that movie was bad.
Yeah.
We're slowly running out of Renaissance era Disney movies to remake into live action, and I want to make an appeal to Disney, even though none of you were on our Patreon.
Well, this is Bobby Eisner or whatever his name is.
Yeah.
He's definitely a $1 a month subscriber to Radio versus the Martians. Maybe he is. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. You know, whoever, if there's a Disney bigwig who is under a false identity.
What's his name? That's Michael Eisner.
Michael Eisner.
But that's the old one. Who's the new one? Bob something. Robert something.
Bob Iker?
Iker?
He's like Alb Biker or whatever.
He's just like a clone of Michael Eisner, and they just changed one letter in his last name.
Exactly.
Sorry.
Like Eichel Meisner is one of our Patreon supporters, I can't stop you from doing this nostalgia porn, and that's really what it is. But I want to make a request. Can you just not make one of them? Just don't make one. Just don't make a live action Oliver and Company or a live action
The Black Cauldron.
Actually, I'd rather see a live action Black Cauldron.
Sure, that may be right.
But if we're not going to make one of these things,
the Aristocats.
Yeah, let's just not make one of them. And
listen, I think Bob Newhart's still alive, so we got to get him in to the
Rescuers or whatever this is. Right. Just don't make one of these. And then use that money to just fucking fix the pipes in Flint, Michigan.
Right. Yes.
Just
agreed.
Just don't make one throwaway nostalgia porn movie and probably save the lives of a bunch of people. Just once.
Here.
It's like, I actually looked it up. I was bored one day and I was just like, how have we not fucking done this by now? How have we not fixed the water in Flint, Michigan? And I'm like, how much could that cost? How much would it cost to do that? And it was like $55 million was the listed amount I saw online. I'm like, that's half an Avengers movie. Why can't we get a bunch of rich people that had to do that? Why can't they stop being greedy for one chunk of time and just get this shit done?
Let's just stop giving Disney our money. In any event, Henry Cavill.
Henry Cavill. No, so, Henry Cavill is great.
So I do like Henry Cavill. There is a bit too much with this. I mean, I knew years ago that this was based on the Polish version of Game of Thrones, essentially. Not really. More of like a Polish J.R.R. Tolkien sort of story. Because it's its own series of novels. And only when I saw the trailer did I realize that it wasn't... This wasn't like the let's cash in on a video game franchise that's extremely popular and has grown a huge audience over the past 10 years. This is a Game of Thrones like series that hopefully Netflix can get its hooks in and have the biggest thing in the world, like like Amazon was trying to do with Lord of the Rings prequel or whatever it is. And I'm like, I just lost a lot of enthusiasm for the idea of seeing it because I'm like,
I think there's
drained from Game of Thrones. I feel like I have fatigue from Game of Thrones, and I really don't want another long form high fantasy serialized series.
Well, they're always going to compare it to Game of Thrones,
of course,
because Game of Thrones is the success story.
Right.
There really are only two high fantasy success stories. It's Game of Thrones and Lord of the Rings.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Willow.
Oh, but that's what I mean, is that there was kind of a short golden age of fantasy when we were kids. We were getting things like Labyrinth and the Dark Crystal and Willow and Neverending Story. They were all happening in probably a span of 5 years. It felt like forever when we were kids, but back then it felt like it was going on forever. How long did elementary school feel when you were a kid? It's not that long.
No.
But what I kind of got was that the fact that these are based on novels rather than just the video games gives me more hope.
Yeah.
Because what is the track record of a video game movie?
Not great.
And I think that's exactly what it is. And I think that the experience of playing, I think I've said this before on the show, but I'm not sure, that the experience of playing a video game and trying to recapture that is a bit of a fool's errand.
Yeah.
Because the thing that makes a video game great is the interactivity. It's the fact that you are controlling it and you have a greater sense of identification, I guess is the word, with the lead character, because for a certain extent, you are that lead character, yeah, making these decisions and doing stuff, that you're sharing in these adventures in a much more intimate way than being an audience member. And that when you translate it, you can't bring that part of that experience with that character with you.
Yeah. One of the reasons why I'm so glad that they dispense with the idea of doing a BioShock movie, which is, it could never be, it feel like the same experience as characters on a screen than it is you playing a character whose control is a big part of the narrative.
Exactly.
Right? There's a whole thing that would be missing out of it. And maybe, maybe
thematically,
the Doom,
it has to be a video game.
Maybe the Doom movie, yeah, maybe, like, is the sort of thing you can do, because what's to a Doom movie other than Mars and hell monsters?
Oh, yeah.
And big guns.
And that little guy grimacing at the bottom of the screen, yeah, with a bloody nose.
Wasn't The Rock in that movie?
Yeah.
I really want to see that movie.
The weird thing is, I think a Doom movie starring The Rock now would be way better than The Rock in the Doom movie then.
I think they're bringing out another Doom movie, but I think it's like a low budget affair, and that makes me sad.
I think if you're going to do Doom, give it to someone like Guillermo del Toro.
Yeah, oh yeah, oh yeah.
And go full on, like, Lovecraftian with it.
Well, I mean, you want to have scary monsters from hell. That's the whole point.
It's basically Arnold as John Matrix versus Lovecraft. That's kind of what you're going to go with. I mean, or just, sort of an army of darkness, like, guy with a chainsaw and a shotgun fighting, like, unwieldy demon monsters that can break your brain.
It's kind of more Hellraiser. There's more Clive Barker in it, I would say, than John Romero.
Yeah, yeah. But I'd say definitely somebody who has a strong visual style would be the person to do. Somebody who can make weird shit. And that's why I always say Del Toro, is Del Toro loves making monsters.
I've got just the director for you. Bradley Cooper.
Bradley Cooper?
Bradley Cooper directs Doom. Coming this summer, 2020.
Oh, geez. I still haven't seen A Star Is Born.
It was bad, but yeah.
But so one thing I kind of wanted to talk about is something that's been happening a lot lately in pop culture, and that's the idea of endings.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah. A lot of major franchises, TV shows, movies, even a comic book series that's been running for a long time have just ended. And people have feelings about this stuff. Mm-hmm, like Game mm-hmm. of Thrones just ended after 8 seasons, and people are not happy about that. They just had Avengers Endgame came out,
right,
and ended essentially a decade's worth of storylines that they've been building since Iron Man, and ended out a couple of characters that are no longer going to be making movies again. So,
right, and presumably there will be an end to the main cycle of characters from Star Wars this year too, which, yes, I think is most germane, because we know now that, like, if your property is successful enough, see Game of Thrones for this, if your property is successful enough, it's never going to end.
Yeah, I don't think that Star Wars is never going to end, but the idea of having episode numbers, I think, will.
Right.
I think that this is probably going to be it for now, probably for a very long time. And they're going to have to scramble and figure out how they're going to do these standalone movies, because they seem to be in a state of flux for how creatively they want to do this stuff.
Yeah.
So, they're figuring it out. I know that they're going to give the two guys from Game of Thrones, as like D.B. Weiss and Dan Benioff, mm-hmm, they're giving them a Star Wars trilogy. I know that they're giving Rian Johnson a separate Star Wars trilogy. So I think this is probably a good place to go. I mean,
I suppose
I have a lot of opinions about the guys from Game of Thrones right now and going, I don't know. But the idea of saying, okay, we're going to build this around trilogies and give them to essentially auteurs, that I like.
I mean, if it falls in the same category as, like, the Alien franchise, for example, which is definitely should be a Radio versus the Martians panel in the future, for yeah, sure. You just have to look at those four movies as, sure, they are sequels in that they exist in the same universe, and Ripley is a character that her story follows from 1 to 2 to 3 to 4. However, really what they are is the same movie retold through the lens of a different director. So,
yeah, until Ridley Scott took it over again and drove it into the ground.
But I mean, that is the reason why I think Alien is fascinating as a trilogy, and you can just sort of lop off everything past number four, but every one of those four movies is its own facet, is its own iteration through a different filter. And that can be interesting. I mean, three and four might have been failures on lots of levels. They're still very interesting, I think.
Oh, I do.
Experiments.
I agree. And it's getting back to this idea of endings. We never really got that ending for Ripley.
Right. That's true.
That movie ends in a way that sort of implies that we're going to get another Aliens movie set on Earth.
That you can just clone Ripley forever, and there will always be a Ripley as long as there are aliens.
And the same thing with like the Spider-Man movies that Sam Raimi did. They just ended because there was negotiations that fell through about scripts and getting people back, and the same thing that happened with the Batman movies in the late 80s, early 90s, the ones with like Val Kilmer and Michael Keaton and eventually George Clooney. Those ones just kind of ended because, I mean, that's what happens a lot with a lot of these franchise stuff. They just kind of peter out. And then occasionally get something like the Nolan Dark Knight trilogy that has a definitive ending.
Right.
That it's really clear at the end of Dark Knight Rises, whatever its faults. I have a lot of respect for the idea that they said, no, we're going to make this the last story of this version of Batman and give it a definitive close and then kind of move on. And that's something characters like Batman very rarely get.
Right, right.
And that's what actually, a couple of months ago, we recorded an episode about stuff in my basement.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I was at a much lower place talking about Marvel than I am now. And part of that is because of Endgame.
Oh, the purge. You had a nice sort of emotional purge.
Yeah. There was a sense, though, with Marvel films that they would just keep going forever and keep adding, and you'd be in this infinite loop of a second act that never ends. And that's the sort of thing you get with these sort of characters. And that there's something to be gained by letting a character in canon age and eventually die is that you get a sense of growth. And you get a sense of moving towards something. And that the finale is one of the most important parts of any story. And the fact that there are characters that are just somehow exempt from that, except if you do something like Dark Knight Returns, which is a possible future.
Right, right.
So what we got with Endgame is something I think we're never going to get Comics, which is these characters have a final story. That, yeah, you can do a story where Captain America is replaced by somebody else and someone else becomes Captain America. But we all know Steve Rogers is going to come back in the comics because he is essentially just ink and paper.
Right, right.
And ink and paper can always come back because he's effectively immortal. That there's never a point where the drawing of Steve Rogers is going to go, I don't want to do any more comics, where Chris Evans can say that.
I mean, there is a big difference, though, is that the audience's attentiveness, the audience's patience for recasting a character and doing it again. Like, so you started with the example of Batman. So it goes from Michael Keaton, Val Kilmer, George Clooney, and effectively they are supposed to be in the same chain of Batman, right?
Yeah,
they're supposed to be the same character, even though the directors change and the actors change.
It's like the James Bond movies where you have, even though James Bond changes, the actress who plays like Moneypenny is the same,
right?
M stayed on for a few more movies.
Right.
There's a continuity to let you know you're part of the same series that you had with Batman, like Michael Gow playing Alfred with all of those movies, and the same, you know, Pat Hingle playing a waste of a Commissioner Gordon.
Well, that said, I mean, I guess if you're projecting forward about what Marvel will do or what Star Wars will do, is I don't think anyone would want to see another Captain America movie where they just hire some other young actor to be Steve Rogers Captain America. And if they do, it's got to be years from now. You know, people would probably not like, you know, them to have a Star Wars episode 10 where Brian Blessed plays Luke Skywalker or something. You know what I'm saying? Like, we don't want that. We now don't want those characters to be endlessly recycled and recast into different actors.
I guess
we're okay with prequels, I suppose.
I think it's inevitable that they will be eventually recast.
Mm.
That it's going to be after a hard reboot of the MCU, though. When who knows how far that is down the line. But what we have right now is, you know, spoilers for Endgame. Tony Stark had the end of his story. His character dies. And we know that Robert Downey Jr. is done with the MCU.
Right.
That maybe he might make some cameo as an AI or something in the future. But there's nothing in the cards for that. So we have a definitive ending that's in, that's intended to be permanent in a way that Tony Stark dying in the comics, which I think has happened before, mm-hmm. never could be. That, like, for instance, at the end, Captain America retires. That he goes back to the 40s and lives his life through there and gives his shield to the Falcon to be the new Captain America. Mm-hmm. And what I love about that is that that was something that happened in the comics, too. That the Falcon did for probably about 3 years of the comics become Captain America. And every comic book fan who's been on this rodeo this long knows that this is not the first time Captain America has been replaced right. by another character. These are one of the big storylines that Captain America Steve Rogers goes through, is that he's either disillusioned or he ages out of it because he loses his super soldier serum or... But either way, he retires or dies or whatever,
right.
and a new person has to take it on. In one case, he was fired by the government or quit, and a right-wing guy named John Walker took over. And there was a kind of commentary on...
Was he a Texas Ranger?
He wasn't a Texas Ranger. He was essentially kind of a MAGA guy back in the 80s. He was that like pro-Reagan, let's take care of this stuff.
The Posse Comitatus guy,
yeah,
sovereign citizen.
Yeah, he was definitely kind of an angry, more violent, I follow orders kind of Captain America, where Steve Rogers was definitely a more thoughtful, I am what America should be, not just a, like a recitation of, you know, whatever the government wants. And, you know, John Walker was a good soldier, so there's a storyline about, well, let's give a certain segment of fans a thing they think they want and show them why it's not good, why this guy shouldn't be Captain America. So, and they've done that before, but you know during that storyline in the 80s, Steve Rogers is coming back. We know during the time where Steve Rogers died in the mid-aughts after Civil War that Bucky took over and he was Captain America for a while. We know Steve Rogers is coming back.
Right.
Then the Falcon becomes Captain America. We know Steve Rogers is coming back. And this is a thing that we don't say about Chris Evans. We know Chris Evans is not coming back. And there's a permanence to this that I really, really like.
I think you're right. I think that's why what we've talked about endlessly when we say why Logan was so great, because it has the same thing. It gives you an ending, but it also its emotional weight is informed by the years and years and years that you, the audience, has lived with that character. That actor embodying that character. And such the same thing you can say with all 20 whatever films of the Marvel Cinematic Universe is like, it allowed us to grow with the characters, to be pulled along with the characters. And the ending was the ending was so emotionally satisfying because we had grown with them, you know.
Yeah, and those
it wasn't the Justice League where you just are just throwing characters in scenes after a movie, because that's what we have to do.
I mean, we see these characters' relationships grow and change. Like, you know, from the very beginning that Captain America and Iron Man have a tense friendship, that they're friends, but it's not an easy friendship.
Right.
It's one where they like and respect each other, but they're frequently at odds with each other because they're very different people. Mm-hmm. And there's a tension there because of that. And over the course of these movies, you see them go from not liking each other to having a grudging respect to really do liking each other. Then you get to see that relationship fall apart, and then they get to reconcile.
Mm-hmm.
And you get to see them both individually go through something where Captain America is a man out of time who doesn't know if he really belongs, but ultimately getting to end up with the woman he loves from his first appearance, who we've never forgotten about.
Right.
And the same thing with Iron Man. That, remember the thing that Iron Man, Steve Rogers says to him in, he's like, what are you without your suit? You're not the guy who's going to make the sacrifice play. And that's what he ultimately does. So right. There's an arc there that has a finale, and it means something because all of these things have sort of built up this part of him, and then ultimately making decision to go, okay, let's give him a finale that fits all of these parts that came before, and make it, it's emotionally resonant and it feels earned because of all that's come before, because you feel like you've traveled with this guy, and you've also seen Robert Downey Jr. age 10 years in this time. Mm-hmm. And that's what gives it a sense of power, is that these relationships he's built with these characters mean something. So in something like Endgame, where it's really kind of Tony's movie and Steve's movie, it's really kind of a closer group of people, you can do things in a lot of shorthand because we've been there for all of these changes. And these things mean something.
Yeah, and I guess to your point about the idea of endings, it's commendable. I mean, not only is, I think, what they achieved from a storytelling perspective, from an adaptation perspective, and from a cinema perspective, I think from the business of cinema, like, they've achieved something that is great. And they've also, they also agreed to have this idea of, well, this, whatever, this first phase, whatever the, I don't know what they call them.
They're
this
calling
phase.
It like the Infinity Saga altogether.
Yeah. Whatever the phase of it is ending, they said, yeah, well, obviously there's an infinite number of stories. There might be an infinite wars. There will also be infinite number of stories to tell because Marvel Comics is huge, or Marvel, the Marvel Universe is huge. They've decided to say, we're going to end this thing, which is, I guess I'm not going to call Disney brave, but the choice to do that is sort of a brave choice, because any more timid, less creative, less thoughtful people would be like, can we do the Police Academy thing and just keep making movies until they lose, until they start losing money and then stop making them, you know?
The money and quality inverse ratio. Right. But yeah, I mean,
let's talk about where, why, so that's a great example, but let's also then switch to the other part, which is, I think, like the
Game of Thrones
is a perfect example of, you know, before it ended, they had teed up 6 prequel series, and I think only a couple of them are actually going to go forward now.
I think that the taste that the finale left in a lot of people's mouths really puts into doubt where they are going forward. Because I think that there is a power to the way your ending leaves people emotionally, that if they feel like the time that they spent on something was not worth it, that mm-hmm. what you move them towards makes them feel ripped off, then they're probably not likely to want to take another bite of that apple. And I think that that was the problem. It's weird because I think the biggest problem with the ending of Game of Thrones...
But I need to interject here, and maybe this is just devil's advocate. Is this just not... The dissatisfaction with it is... This just not the sour grapes of fan entitlement, who's saying like, "Well, it didn't end up the way we."
There's always that part is going to be there regardless of how any series ends ever.
Sure,
even if they're in a minority. But I don't think that's what this is. I think this was a legitimately bad ending.
Okay.
Not because of a bullet point version of everything that happens, because I know that they ran out of books after like the middle of season 5. That's when they ran out of stuff. And I think that Benioff and Weiss, during the first 4 seasons, did a really, really good job of adapting material into something else. And mm-hmm. one thing they do really well is they pare things down, they simplify, and they capture the things that really matter. I think that the beauty of Game of Thrones is its very character-steered storytelling.
Right.
That characters have these big shocking fates, but they're only shocking if you're used to reading other genre fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're used to characters escaping impossible odds and doing incredible things. And we know that there's what they call plot armor around a lot of them.
Right.
And what Game of Thrones did was add this stark consequence to their world. That the things that you do, even small, have these big consequences that ring out later and change the story, not just for them, but for other people.
Copyright that phrase, the stark consequence.
Yeah.
Sorry.
But it is. I mean, if you look at it, literally is a stark consequence. Because Ned Stark is this character right. who we are kind of geared towards decades of watching and reading and consuming fiction to thinking this is the hero of our story, mm-hmm. that he's this noble, kind of rigid, decent guy who's thrown into a snake pit of political vice and corruption. And, you know, he's a sheriff who's going to clean up this town.
Right.
He's told, he's basically made the prime minister of this country, of a king that would rather drink and whore and fight himself into an early grave, who's not good at being a king,
right.
but was his best friend when they were kids. And you think, oh, okay, this is our lead character, because he's like the patriarch of this family, we're going to go forward. That's not how things work out. And the fate that Ned Stark has, his death, is entirely based on Ned Stark's inability to stop being Ned Stark.
Right.
That right. he can't stop being himself so hard that he walks right into that fate. And when you rewatch it or reread that first book, it seems so obvious
right.
what he's moving towards. Because when we know what's coming, we can just go, dude, just stop, stop, stop. It's like, oh, there's the guy who had my job previously died under mysterious circumstances investigating the thing I'm investigating openly now. And I know people are spying on me. And he's just like, oh, let him spy. Because it's like he doesn't want to be a part of this snake pit world.
Right.
So he refuses to adapt to it. And yeah, they have him fucking killed. They have him accused of treason and chop his fucking head off. And it's shocking. But it's shocking because we live in a world where we consume fiction. In real life, that dude dies. That guy does not sit on the throne at the end of any real life scenario. That assholes have a tendency to survive like cockroaches because they don't have that sort of moral stoppage. So we have a thing like that that plays out, and it's allowed to play out. It's allowed to take a whole season to get from point A to point B.
Right.
We're allowed to sort of explore the world through Ned's eyes, and it makes sense that he ends up where he does because the character is steering it. Once they ran out of novels, I think it became much more plot-based.
Yes. Yep.
That I think that they had conversations with George R. R. Martin, and he wrote them down a bullet point and with very, very slim ideas. Okay, this is where this character ends up. This character comes here. This is their ultimate fate. This is what happens to Hodor. This is what happens to Daenerys.
Right.
But it was very brief. And what they ended up doing, that once they had that information and they say, okay, we're going to be done at the end of season 8, and these are going to be shorter last seasons, is that now we're moving towards a thing. We're not letting the character steer. We have a deadline and we got to move from A to B. And it's not the character steering anymore. It's the plot steering the characters.
Yeah. Yeah.
So people seem to be acting dumber than they normally would. They seem to be acting quicker than they ever would. That's why we're jumping around the map super fast. That's why these things seem to be changing at a whiplash pace that feels unnatural because we're used to smart characters not being this dumb. And again, the eventual fate of Daenerys, a sort of descent into madness, if that had been given a long time, that could have been great.
Right, right. Agreed.
But I mean, that's the thing. Even Martin says that he would have liked to have at least like 13 seasons. And if you had built that up, and I think it really just came down to these are my bullet points. Bran becomes the king, Daenerys becomes the Mad Queen, Jon Snow goes north, you know, and it's all these things. And we don't, and this is a point that somebody else made on YouTube. I forget who it is. I want to give them credit, but I don't know. I don't want to take credit for this point on my own, which is that these characters being played by these actors have evolved into different people than the people in the books. Because the books and these things are pulling in slightly different directions. Those little differences in relationships change these characters. Like, for instance, Tyrion. In the books, he falls in love with a prostitute named Shay that he kind of knows that, you know, he's paying this woman to be in love with him. And he knows that if he's caught with her, then she's going to be murdered and he's going to lose his political power, that he's done. His father has given him that warning. And in the books, they have a very different relationship than the relationship that they have on the show. In the show, she's sort of jealous of the fact that he's been forced to marry Sansa. She's, you know, it feels much more like a real relationship on the show. There's a push and a pull, and they, where her characters in the books are very sort of demure, and she gives him everything that he wants and seems to be open to anything. And the reveal that, of course, she's just this way because she's been paid to be, and she turns on him in a heartbeat to survive. Yeah, that makes sense, because in the books, she was never in love with him. And the thing is, in the books, he knew she was never in love with him, but he didn't want to admit it because he's so starved for love. That it turns his brain off, and we spent an entire book and a half with him being so starved for love and him basically countermanding his own brain and saying, no, keep her around, take this risk, that of course when things start to fall apart, of course she's going to testify against him to save her own life because she's basically an actor. And that was the difference. So when he turns on her and basically commits murder in the books, it's this big deal, and it plays totally different than him killing somebody who he fooled himself into thinking she loved him versus a person who really did love him but felt hurt by him. These are very different situations.
Yeah.
And it also changes that scenario of having him ultimately murder her. In the books, it's far more, you see this person kind of drinking into this dark place. In the movie, or in the TV show, it feels a lot darker. It's like, yes. How do you get him to do this thing without becoming a monster? And here's the thing I'm thinking in the books. I think Tyrion is going to become the villain.
Oh.
I think Daenerys is going to become the villain, but instead of him being the Jiminy Cricket.
Because the only groundwork they lay for Daenerys is, well, besides her heritage, is like, well, when we took the cities on the east, like
Meereen, the slaver.
Yeah,
Bay.
Yeah. I mean, she crucified a bunch of people. Yeah. Oh, okay. All right.
I mean, she's always been cruel.
Okay.
I mean, that's always been a part of her that's really off-putting. Is that she has this cruelty to
everyone,
her.
Including the Starks, just make commands to kill a bunch of people. So that's not significant enough.
Well, I know, but she shares this with Cersei in the sense of, I'm going to stand here looking cold while somebody is being murdered right in front of me and not care.
Right.
And that's kind of scary because even Sansa at her worst, somebody has to do something really horribly directly to her to take her to that point. But Daenerys has that aspect of her, but it's tempered by the fact that she's also incredibly kind.
Yeah, and that she's been under the boot heel before, so she knows what it feels like.
So she ends up taking that sort of anger and cruelty and directs it at really awful people. So if you're going to say that she is eventually going to break and become who her father was, that's a great story if you allow it to play out in a way that feels natural.
Hmm.
And they didn't really do that.
No, I don't think they did either.
And it's a shame because that's a story that I think that Emilia Clarke would have been amazing at. The building that character, getting a chance. And I think in the books, this Tyrion story again, I don't think he's going to be the angel on her shoulder in the books. I think he's going to be the devil on her shoulder.
Hmm.
I think that he is going to be a part of her downfall in a way. And this is something that I've been thinking about because Tyrion is my favorite character. I get so much in his head. But in the fifth book, he's in a very dark fucking place. And he really is the person who just says, yeah, that place hurt me. I did everything I could to protect poor, small people that were being stomped under the boot heels of rich men fighting each other in King's Landing when I was Hand of the King, and they called me nothing but a freak and a spider monkey and all these horrible things that they insulted me with. Fuck them. After all of that, they're going to have me murdered? Fuck them. Burn this place to the ground. And I could see him being a very different person for the rest of the books. And having both of the two of the most beloved characters being a slow villain origin story is actually pretty cool.
Hmm.
That rather than being the best thing that happened, the thing that's holding her back from being her worst self, he ends up being the person that indulges that. Because who is she to be setting on fire? His fucking sister.
Right. Yeah. I mean, Peter Dinklage became sort of like the most likable character in that, you know, I mean, Sansa and Arya, I suppose, but even they were not as glowingly lead as Tyrion is. And so perhaps part of the concession that
is they didn't want to make him that
evil.
And
that's
the change in adaptation. Is that suddenly, maybe. You know, I don't know.
So all of this notwithstanding, I mean, I think I share, for the most part, I share the idea with you that there was a sincere sense of letdown of where I had thought, and I'm not as versed as you are. I haven't read the books, of course, that I was like, well, I don't think these characters would behave this way. So that was,
no.
I got that sense very palpably just being someone who's a Fairweather fan. Moving on from here, are you likely to spend the time to want to watch the prequels? Cause there was one thing that I said after Endgame was done. I was like, this was great. I'm glad I watched all of them. I'm not going to go to the movie theater and spend more money watching Marvel movies anymore. And I kind of feel like I have the same thought about Game of Thrones is I'm not really going to spend any money subscribing to a HBO service. I don't now. But just to watch the prequels because I'm not that interested. I've sort of been turned down.
I mean, I get that. I think that endings are also a great jumping off point. And it's fine. It's fine to walk away going, hey, this is as good an ending as I'm ever going to get. And another film franchise that ended recently had one of those great moments that it went past. And that was the X-Men. that X-Men franchise has been going.
Oh my god,
since...
did you see Dark Phoenix?
I did. I did see Dark Phoenix. There's things in it I like, but it's just not good. And the thing that makes me really sad was that
this was specifically an end to these characters. Was it an explicit end?
Or... No, it's clear that, I mean, it could work as an end, but to me it feels like they're clearly moving towards a sequel that's never coming out.
Right, right.
The idea that they did with the soft reboot prequel X-Men movies is actually a pretty good one. The idea of we're going to do period pieces that jump ahead 10 years in time. It gets a little bit weird considering that, you know, Hank McCoy has basically looked this age since the 1960s through the 90s. They didn't age him a little bit more, but I don't know. Maybe it's because they're mutants. But I'm going to say, I hope I age like Michael Fassbender's Magneto that is in the 90s looking pretty fucking good for a guy who was a child during World War II.
Right, sure.
And I would say that they had two opportunities to just kind of have their last movie, and they didn't take it, and instead they stuck around too long. Days of Future Past was the first time they had something that felt like, wow, this would be a great place to stop.
Yep.
That we did a time travel story that made fixing continuity part of the plot, that still felt streamlined, it still felt good, it still felt like a story rather than just house cleaning under the guise of a movie. And when you're a fan of nerd shit, it's easy to fall into fixing things or filling plot holes or reversing course on movies that didn't go well and then forgetting to tell a story. I think we said it was like, it's a guitar solo that forgets to sing a song. It never really goes anywhere. It's just kind of doing its thing. But it did. It told a story and used that, and you jump ahead to the near future and everything is actually looking pretty fucking good, and you get kind of a goodbye moment to the original cast, and it's a great place to stop with the new cast. And they didn't take it, and they made two more movies that weren't good. And it feels like a shame. The other place was Logan. Logan would have been a really cool place to end it, because you're like, holy shit, that is a great film. And the X-Men film franchise has got a wide pendulum swing of quality.
Right, right. And from what I know from the very little that you have, I think on one of the shows, was it a Black Ops show where we talked about the screwy continuity behind the lineage of Cable, I think was we were talking about. I was also reading someone talking about the span of what X-Men has been doing over the past decade, and apparently it's just all over the place.
Yeah.
Apparently it's a peanut butter and jelly on the wall sort of thing.
In a weird sort of way, that's probably the place where the X-Men movies are the best and most faithful adaptation of anything ever, which is continuity is a fucking mess.
Right.
And you shouldn't think about it too hard, or otherwise your brain will break. It's like, it basically will do to your head if you try to take it completely seriously. Any one of those episodes of classic Star Trek where Captain Kirk gets a computer to blow itself up with a logic loop, it feels like that, where you're like, just don't, because you're just like... It's like you're Nomad at the end of that episode, and the contradiction kills you. But it's a bit like that, but it's a series that ended. We have a definitive ending not because of a choice, but because of a corporate buyout.
Right.
That the last X-Men movie, Dark Phoenix, from what I understand, lost a lot of money, and I think that it probably lost as much money as it did because there was the sense that now that they'd been bought out by Disney, that it didn't matter.
Well, this is also I've talked about this before, the Into Darkness effect, where Into Darkness made a shit ton of money, made a lot of money, probably not as much as Paramount wanted it to, but based on the momentum of the 2009 was great, but also because of the reaction of people who saw Into Darkness and felt, had that sort of episode one feeling. I like to call it the episode one feeling, where as you go through the movie and you get out and you think that was great, but as time goes along, you don't like it anymore. And so when it comes time to pony up the cash for the next movie,
you don't do it.
And so the sad part in this instance was that Beyond was very good. I thought it was really strong, and I was hoping that we could still move on a line where they're increasing that quality and sort of returning to form, taking those same, I think, really well-cast characters and weaving them into more interesting ideas. But of course, the Into Darkness effect meant that fewer people saw it because they got stung on the last movie, you know?
Yeah.
And then now we have Star Trek, the Star Trek 4 movie sort of melting away. Although Quentin Tarantino says that he wants his Star Trek idea to be the 10th and final, his 10th and final movie before
Seriously?
He quits, before he quits directing, he wants to direct a Star Trek movie.
That is so fucking weird because with Quentin Tarantino, he's always said that, again, this is an ending too. Mm-hmm. The idea of this wanting to be his final movie, that I'm going to make 10 movies and then finish. But the fact that somebody who has had 3 movies nominated for Best Picture is going to want to make his last movie ever a franchise movie.
Yes.
A licensed franchise movie.
Something that he has just obviously refused to do over the... He could... I'm sure Fox or Disney or Paramount could have thrown any number of franchises. I'm sure they probably want him to direct like a Bond movie or something, you know, or a Mission Impossible movie, and he's swatted them all down up until now.
Yeah, it's such a weird thing, too, because the closest that we've gotten to him is him doing an adaptation of an Elmore Leonard novel.
Right.
That's as close as we've gotten. And everything else has been an original property, all of which that he's written and directed. It's so strange that he would make it his last movie.
And this one actually, it will be written by someone else, too.
It's going to be written by someone else?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that'd be it's weird.
It is bizarre. It's a strange
weird
thing.
That his last movie that he's ever going to direct is going to be written by somebody else. That is weird.
Yep. I mean, and this is all in the level of maybes, probably maybes. But I mean, the thing about Quentin Tarantino is that people will give him, even after the disintegration of the Weinstein Company, right? As that completely imploded, it didn't matter. People will throw money at Quentin Tarantino.
Oh yeah.
Even if he makes another Death Proof, you know, like
I still haven't seen that.
Oh, you haven't seen Death? It's definitely worthwhile seeing. It's clearly on the lower tier of his films. But I mean, if you like what Quentin Tarantino does, you'll like this.
I do.
I mean, even after Death Proof, I mean, I don't think as many people went to see Inglourious Bastards.
I didn't see it in theaters, but I loved it on HBO.
But a lot of people probably that was too much for them, that probably they couldn't do it. I think Django is what was his big first success. I mean, that was the huge box office success.
Django.
They're all great, but it is so bizarre to think of it, to think of him doing the Star Trek thing, but because people will throw him money because he's Quentin Tarantino and he is like this. It's like Atos. You remember the librarian from the original series episode, Atos, who's just sort of like the keeper of the lore. He's the sage. That's Quentin Tarantino. And so I think studios are willing to throw that anything they can at him. The only hitch to this is that this pivots on the CBS-Paramount merger that's happening right mm-hmm. now, as well as whatever politics are in play over there. Because it is someone's franchise, and they are making it the backbone of their streaming service right now. So, of course, they're going to be a little more gun-shy than they normally would. If it were 10 years ago, they probably would have said, yes, Quentin Tarantino, do a Star Trek reboot movie for us.
Is,
you know?
Is Picard also going to be on that streaming network?
The new Picard show? The Star Trek Picard? Yes, that will also
be on. That's another...
That's a good idea for ending is, I hope this is...
The last
the Logan.
Story.
I hope this is the Logan for Picard.
Who was also in Logan.
That's true.
Patrick Stewart.
He did have his ending in that one, too. But, you know, like, we had a real disappointing, incredibly disappointing last movie with the Next Generation movies.
So you think it's going to be like Worf holding Picard up so he can use the toilet?
just feeding him Earl Grey tea with his poor, his little frail neck. His skeletal-like body. It was sad. Man, it was so super sad to see.
God, that's what I think that's one thing I kind of love is that... I guess we said there's two different kinds of dark storytelling. One that I tend to like, and one of them that... So I think that the way adults draw, you know, write a dark story tends to be sad, where I think the sort of adolescent kind of dark storyline tends to be angry.
Yes.
It's the difference between Batman v Superman and Logan, for instance.
Sure.
Is that there's a kind of like, sorry, these are my feelings. But I think I think that if there's a tone that just works on me every fucking time, and maybe it's because I just turned 40, it's wistful.
Yeah.
Holy shit, does wistful work on me. Like, I'm finishing up. I'm
trying to think of the last wistful movie that I saw. Continue.
Like, Logan has a lot of wistful in it. The sense of sad loss, but there's sort of a bittersweet trying to find some meaning in a thing ending kind of feeling. That shit just works on me. The sense of just, like, characters getting older and the sense that you're moving towards this inevitable finale that isn't going to be the end of Star Wars A New Hope. You're not going to be standing in a line with medals around your neck with people applauding. There's a sense of, I just have to make the best of this. And that shit just works on me. There's things. And a lot of that is I just finishing up playing Red Dead Redemption 2, that I just got into the epilogue scenarios of that game. And that game is all about wistful sadness.
Does the epilogue have to do with your character dies and then immediately he becomes a zombie?
No.
Oh, okay.
That's Undead Nightmare.
That would be pretty cool if they did it the second time.
The thing with a lot of open world games is that you want to keep playing even after the story ends. And they have a way of doing that in this. Is it okay for me to spoil a video game that came out at the end of last year?
I mean, when I talked about a minor spoiler on Fallout 4, which I think is the only time that I received any flack, me personally received any flack for what I said on the podcast. So I guess tread with caution, I suppose.
So
people are very serious about their open world games.
And I'll say this too. I've been playing Red Dead Redemption 2 since right after Christmas. I got this game for Christmas.
Nice.
And I guess I've been nursing this game for a while, and not just because life gets in the way, podcasts get in the way. I'm not as big a video game guy as I think you are and a lot of people in our community are. So I will play one game for a really long time, and then I won't play anything for 2 years. So it's just, the comics are my thing.
Sure.
Video games I enjoy. But I love the shit out of Red Dead Redemption 2 because it's a game about being it has that Logan kind of quality, is that the world that I was a part of, the world that I was built for, is dying. And there's no place for me in the new world. But I have this one last chance to do something good before I die. And in Red Dead Redemption 2, something that happens kind of in the late middle part of the game is your character realizes that he has tuberculosis.
Oh, whoa.
And, awesome. And that's, you can cool. kind of pinpoint the part of the game where he contracts it. It's him sort of at his worst. That one of these, there's missions that you go on where you're part of a gang that sort of creates itself as half cult, half family, but you're outlaws. You take in a lot of runaways. You take in a lot of people that have nowhere else to go. And you knew about this gang from Red Dead Redemption 1 because the last surviving members of that gang are the people you're hunting down.
Oh.
So Dutch is the head of this gang saying, treating it like there's almost this philosophy to what we do, that we represent freedom of the Old West, and we just got to get this one big score. And then we can go live on an island in the South Pacific somewhere and finally achieve this dream of freedom and whatever, even though we've spent the last 20 years robbing banks, hurting people, but occasionally doing Robin Hood shit, which is the stuff that gives you the sense that, well, we're not bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
And the game takes place in 1899 after your last big score has gone horribly sour and you've been hiding out in the mountains for a while. And what it's really about is how a group like this would deteriorate. How you learned that this guy that you've looked up to as sort of a father figure and a leader is not the person under pressure that you want him to be. That he's not a good person. And it's a game about falling out of love with your family.
Wow.
And having to become a different person. And when he's got sort of a ticking clock of, as your character gets sicker and sicker, and it affects your gameplay. So at the very end, that snap to auto aim gets really, really not great.
Can I just say for a second here, and I will let you continue. After what happened with Grand Theft Auto 5, which is we didn't get any more single-player DLC, the likes of which for GTA 4, I think were all really good. They're really enjoyable. Because the online component was a money printing machine.
Yeah.
They're like, we're no more single player DLCs. It is incredible to me that Rockstar with Red Dead Redemption 2 decided to go to push all of the chips to the center of the table on making a compelling story, as opposed to just being like, well, this is just Red Dead Redemption Online and we're going to have heists and you can keep going. I'm sure they do have Red Dead Redemption Online that you can play, but I'm really happy that they didn't decide to dispense with the single player grand story altogether.
It's the best game that they've ever done. Hmm. I really do think. And it's hard because I loved Red Dead Redemption 1, but there's that sense of sadness in it that when, as you see kind of Dutch Vanderlyn, the leader of this gang slash family, become worse and worse, and see him make worse and worse decisions because you're kind of his right-hand guy. You're the one that he takes counsel from, and he starts taking it less and less from you and start listening to you and starts taking more risks, start doing things that just seem kind of needlessly violent and needlessly vindictive and needlessly risky. And you start thinking more and more about the people around you. And also your honor rating in the game does affect the way the game ends. Mm. That if you are a person that has been, and I always play a good guy in these games, I can't be a chaotic evil bad guy in video games.
It's hard for you to play Trevor in GTA 5, right?
Yeah, it's weird. So you have to make a couple decisions near the end of the game that affect the way that game goes. And it's probably one of the most emotionally affecting, I felt the most invested in this game, of with Arthur Morgan, the lead, of any video game character I've ever played.
Hmm, wow.
And I think the fact that it's taken me so long to play it, that I play it in maybe an hour or so at a time, maybe once or twice a week, and I've been playing this since December. So the transition from these different eras of this gang is it starts falling apart and you start losing people, more bad decisions keep getting made, and it's clear that this happy ending of us all living on an island is not going to happen, and that you're going to have to do something to stand up to this boss to protect the other people in the group is coming more and more inevitable, to the point that it's clear that this guy doesn't really care about you, and what a heartbreak that is. And playing it more slowly has only made that more powerful because it feels like it's a much longer relationship. It also changes your relationship with the first game because now you understand the relationship with John, and because John is a minor character in Grand Theft Auto and Red Dead Redemption 2.
Mm-hmm.
And you get to see him and his backstory too. And you realize that you are creating the scenario that is eventually what drives him to the place he is in.
Well, what gives John Marston his redemption, right?
Yeah.
His titular redemption.
You kind of have to die to give him the ability to become that person that's able to escape that life.
Hmm. Crazy.
Which he that's ultimately awesome. Doesn't escape. But it's
so can I say that this also, given that I don't know if it's the GTA guys that are doing the script writing this story, but can I say that the evolution of the story of the Grand Theft Autos, starting with, I think the first two didn't really have a story as much. It really started with 3, which was a bare-bone skeleton of a story. By the time you got to 5, that sort of very snarky, hyper-real take, parody of American culture and the way we see ourselves, or the way other people see us, was kind of wearing very thin, I think. And in this, it actually seems like, well, the idea of telling a genuine affecting story deepens, and it's less of making a parody of a Western, of a prototypical Western.
I think so, too. And I think that's a difference, I think, between the Red Dead Redemption franchise and the Grand Theft Auto franchise. I like the Grand Theft Auto franchise, but I think that ultimately it has a lot of bad writing habits. And that it's got a bad case of edgelord-itis.
Yeah.
Yes. That it has a lot of the same bad habits that the South Park guys do, which is it's saying, oh, it's satire, but really all they're doing is saying, that person believes a thing, so they're stupid, and right. I'm above it all, and I don't care about things. And that's sort of like that sort of apathy and ignorance kind of being lionized, where they think they're saying something, but it's not as deep as the thing they think they're saying.
Well, this is actually, there's one point of sort of cultural synchronicity that clearly affected the creation of Grand Theft Auto 5, because this is the only one I can talk about, because I haven't played Red Dead Redemption 2, but I'm just playing through, again, through GTA 5 right now. And they are, of course, a lot of different movies and things, TV shows that they pull from to sort of create the pastiche universe of Grand Theft Auto. But one of them is Heat.
Mm-hmm.
And it is fascinating that you you kind of have sort somewhat stand-in characters from Heat as characters that are sort of the heist makers in this crew in Grand Theft Auto 5. And one of the through lines of Heat is that it's a that the people that are on this level, the criminals that are on this level, are people that have lives that are disposable, right? They be ready to, De Niro says it several times, like, be ready to drop anything in your life at a minute when if you need to leave, and care about nothing. And as much as that makes for an easy out for making a game about crime where you don't have to care about anything, right? You can just run around shooting or whatever. I felt like that was a great bit of synchronicity where it was like, oh, these characters are kind of like the characters in Heat, where it's a rough life. People die very easily because of how violent it is. And they also just have to be willing to say, okay, this part of my life is over. I have to go. That gives it a little credibility.
Yeah.
But then again, that exists in the sort of the same orbit as the fact that Franklin has to be sort of a weird stand-in character for San Andreas, as like a copy character of CJ in a little bit. And Trevor is just, as I think you've said many times, is just a parody of the what a Grand Theft Auto player feels like they are, mm-hmm. right? So it, there's not a lot of sincerity, I guess.
That's the thing that is missing, that I think that you don't see. There are these little aspects of satire in Red Dead Redemption and Red Dead Redemption 2, but they feel a lot more sincere. That's really the word that it is. It feels like they take these characters a lot more seriously and the world a lot more seriously, and that when something bad happens, I mean, it's not just, oh, wow, that was funny how stupid that was. There's a lot more sense of just, what are we doing? Like, or later on in the missions of Red Dead Redemption 2, you start sort of helping this Native American tribe that's getting fucked over by the government. Government's breaking the treaties against them, brutalizing them, withholding vaccines that they're supposed to get and food, and basically fucking them over. And you see Dutch basically stoking the flames of a younger tribal member to try to start a war between them and the government so that they can use it as cover to escape. And it's so clear that Dutch doesn't give a shit, while you're kind of playing intermediary, trying to stop people from shooting and getting all this stuff, people killed, because there's a recognition that the tribal chief and even Arthur Morgan has that there's no winning that fight, that there's nothing glorious about getting yourself murdered for nothing, because it's not just about you, it's about all the people around you. And that's mm-hmm. the same thing he's going through. And it's never treated as, oh my God, that was so funny. There's this element of just tragedy and doom hanging over everything that, you know, we understand that there is no way to win. And that all you can do is sort of decide who you're going to be in your loss. Mm-hmm. And are you going to be a monster, or are you going in, are you going to... You're going to, that gets, I mean, you can have your big glorious Klingon death, but you can get a bunch of other people hurt and killed.
Right.
Is it worth it?
That reminds me, I wonder, so I just for the very first time at the beginning of this year, watched Bonnie and Clyde, the 1967 movie, Bonnie and Clyde. And then I think Netflix had a movie that was about the Texas Ranger guys who eventually killed Bonnie and Clyde. And there is also that through line with the whole thing is they... We're on the Bonnie and Clyde and the Barrows gang. We're on this trajectory where it sounds sort of like the gang, the Dutch's gang, essentially. They're on this trajectory is that, yeah, they represented a type of freedom, and that type of freedom was for a time when people are living in poverty and when people are disenfranchised is popular with people's romantic notions of some ideas. It really ends up being this sort of nihilistic journey of self-destruction, right? Yeah.
And we just decide, oh, going down in flames, this would be, there's really no glory in it. And then afterwards, nobody cares. And that's one of the saddest things in, like, the series The Wire, too, is that when Omar is shot,
right,
it's not a glorious death.
No.
It's a kid. It's a kid that shoots him in the back when he's trying to buy Honey Nut Cheerios.
Right.
and he's forgotten almost immediately. He's this legendary figure who's forgotten almost immediately.
Well, that's it. I don't know if we talked about this on the podcast last time. That's a through line for a lot of Westerns as well, is that Westerns have this, because there is this glory days, this glory age of like, well, you are the toughest gunfighter, around here. And the problem with you with being that, like, yes, you're great, is that you just absorb endless challenge. And so you, it's great in that you have notoriety and fame in a time when before fame was actually a thing. It's terrible, however, because every place you go, somebody is with a gun will try to kill you. And but, you can't rest. You will never be able to rest.
But even with that, the sense of what is the Old West, there's so many movies that are Westerns and about this era of American history. But if you actually look at how long of a period that was, it wasn't that long.
No.
That we're talking about the end of the Civil War until World War I.
It's weird to think of the fact that when Westerns started growing in pop, I mean, they were Westerns forever in cinema, but when they grew in popularity, peaked in the 50s, that there were still a lot of people who would go to see Westerns in the movie theater because they were kids during that time.
Yeah.
Which it's not that long. If you would be 60 years old and you could be like, well, yeah, I definitely lived on a farm in a very rural place, and this movie reminds me of how I grew up.
Yeah, it's strange because you look at that and it's at most 40 years of time between the Civil War and essentially a world of World War One that, you know, in the blink of an eye, suddenly you have airplanes and cars and tear gas. And, you know, suddenly, you know, military guys wearing helmets rather than just cloth caps with a giant plume on it. I mean, this, everything changes really, really fast. And it's scary how quickly telephones and stuff like that starts coming in. And it's a completely different world very soon. And the idea that this is going to last forever doesn't. I mean, if you look at, you know, a Mad Max type world, there's no sense that, you know, civilization is closing in on, you know, Mad Max.
Right.
We're at the end of it, where in a lot of ways it's kind of the apocalypse followed by civilization rather than the other way around, mm-hmm. in a Western, mm-hmm. that there's this impending sense that there are fewer places that you can just get away with doing whatever the fuck you want. That there's a sadness in that, but there's also the sense of, yeah, I'm glad that people can't show up and burn my barn down because they want to buy my house. You know, that's right. A lot harder to do nowadays, right. than it used to be.
Right.
That usually if a rich guy wants to fuck you over, he'll do it in the courts, and he'll do it far more effectively than sending a bunch of guys around with torches.
You just reminded me too, we can weave this back, is that the Deadwood movie ended the series in a place where the Deadwood series, 13, 14 years ago, went for 3 seasons and then got canceled by HBO. They finally got their act together and made a movie that caps off the narrative, albeit it does it in a way that is even less faithful to the historical events on which Deadwood is based. But however, I would say was a shockingly satisfying conclusion to a show that I think is one of the greatest American television shows of all time.
Do you think it's better for the fact that there was this long break?
No, I mean, if they would have done the same movie a year later, I think the actors are definitely more aged. I think the thing that strains credibility a little bit is that some of the actors are too much older than they were before. But it's fine because they, you know, all of those that are still alive, minus, let's see, who is it? Cy Tolliver. I can't remember who plays Cy Tolliver. What's his name? He died. Powers Booth. Powers Booth?
Mm-hmm.
He died, so his character is not in there. And there's a couple other people. In any event, like the characters that you knew and love are all basically there to wind out their stories. The sad part about it is I think they don't give enough of them enough time to sort of spin out and really, really, really satisfactorily end some of those plot lines.
Would you have wanted another season rather than a movie?
No. I mean, I think it was very deftly done. I think it moved too quickly. It moved too quickly because, and part of that's the expectation of being like, well, Deadwood tells its stories very slowly. You mm-hmm. know, like season one of Deadwood is a very short period of time, really, in the when Seth Bullock and Saul Starr set up their hardware store and become the law. Essentially, that's it. And this, of course, needs to wrap it up in like 2 hours or something. But I mean, there's that element of in Deadwood that was also in Red Dead Redemption, which is like George Hurst wants to throw up telegraph poles and he's going to strong arm people out of their land because their land is right where he wants to build his telegraph poles, you know? So there was that sense of the idea that civilization is impending and we will either join it or be ran over by it.
Yeah. You know? Because always, and this hasn't changed, is that it's the most dangerous place to be is in the shadow of a rich guy's foot.
But I'm on the subject of things that end. I've been pretty happy with endings lately, for sure. And just because I didn't put a finer point on it, if they do two seasons or whatever of the, even if they do one season of this Picard show, and they can really like
give it a definitive ending,
make it seem like the Picard that we knew and love as this, that they write the character well. They don't sort of do the Star Trek Discovery thing, which is, well, we'll bring back a character that you know because that's part of the cachet of the series, but it's a different actor and it's the writers don't understand who the character is and what they should be doing in the story as a part of the greater universe. If they can do that, that's fine. I mean, I think Michael Chabon is the showrunner, and so, you know, he's a Pulitzer Prize winning author. Maybe he can do it. I don't know. But if they can wrap Picard up in a nice bow, that would be great. That would be nice. To me, it would redeem how terrible Nemesis was as a way to end that storyline. And also, I think how Discovery has sort of failed to, up until this point, Discovery has sort of failed to sort of find the spark for Star Trek. I think, well, let's see. It's this year, so it's not too long from now.
So there's one more thing that recently ended that I want to talk about. I haven't read this ending yet because it happens so suddenly, and I'm a trade reader, so I don't read monthly comics. I read them when the collections come out. Mm-hmm. It's just easier for me. The Walking Dead just ended.
Oh, shit. Wow, I didn't know that.
The comic book series that the TV show is based on, the comic has been coming out since 2003.
That's incredible.
It's a crazy thing.
And Robert Kirkman wrote the whole run, right?
He wrote the whole run. It's all his. The first six issues are drawn by a guy named Tony Moore, but then it was handed off to Charlie Adlard. And Charlie Adlard has drawn this comic series from issue 7 until 193, which is the final issue.
Wow.
So that's one art team for all but the first trade.
That's incredible.
And at the end of
Man, it takes me so long to draw one picture. I cannot imagine doing it 190 times.
How many panels?
Versus how many pages. Yeah.
And so that means that this will eventually be in trade paperback form. 33 volumes.
Wow.
And here's the weird thing with how it ended. The Walking Dead was getting really close to issue 200. And there's a lot of buzz, especially in comics, for numbers. Comic fans are really big on big things happening on issue 25, 50, 7500.
Right.
And especially when you get close to something like 200, because there are very few comics nowadays that have uninterrupted 200 issue runs. I think the last ones that are sort of around that are like 2000 AD. I don't know if I really count Action Comics and Detective Comics because they renumbered briefly during the new 52.
Hmm.
But there really aren't a lot of big numbers on comic book covers anymore. Right. And there was a sense of, oh my God, something big is going to happen in issue 200. And Robert Kirkman was really cagey about that. And they didn't announce that Walking Dead was ending until the week that the last issue was coming out.
Whoa.
And the way comic books are solicited, they release a cover 3 months in advance. So Walking Dead was putting out fake covers.
That's amazing.
For 3 months, they put out fake covers for issues they knew were never coming out, with fake synopses. And they released it, and they go, oh yeah, it's ending this week. And they did that like on a Sunday or Monday. They released, oh yeah, the last issue of Walking Dead.
3 days from now.
Issue 193 after all the talk of and hints about what we're going to do with 200, and I guess that was the thing he said. He said he's been writing this series forever, and one of the things that he liked to do was a sense of surprise, that you don't know when something's going to happen. And all of a sudden, a character dies, or something happens that radically changes it. And he goes, but if the way, and this is his mindset, and I'm fascinated by it. I don't necessarily know if it's where I think everyone should go, which is that when you tell people, oh, hey, we're ending at the end of this year, you watch everything in that last season with that in mind.
Right, right.
So you're kind of geared for, oh, okay, this must be permanent happening. Like you see a character in an inescapable situation, you go, oh, they're really going to die here. And you start kind of gearing up emotionally for it to end. And he says, well, what if I didn't do that? What if they didn't know that they're reading the last story arc?
That's so awesome. That is so awesome. That is incredibly bold considering, I'm sure, is it Image?
That's Image is doing, yeah.
I'm sure that they were basically being like, you know, you could keep going for another 10 years, right? We would pay you a bunch of money to keep going.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure Image wants them, him to keep going.
And that's the beauty of Image, is that Image is a company that they own only that I logo. And their distribution services and all that stuff. As far as like intellectual property, it's just that logo.
Makes me more interested in what he's going to do next.
Oh, yeah.
Because I was burnt out on zombie stuff long ago, and I can only imagine what do you choose to do next?
He's done a couple. He has a sci-fi series called Oblivion Song that he's working on. Mm. He's another one called Die, Die, Die. I think he might be close to wrapping up Outcast, which is really good, has gorgeous art. That's one about demonic possession that he's doing.
Weird.
And you kind of get the sense for a while, because he had two really long-running series that had started in the early aughts. One was The Walking Dead, and the other one was Invincible. Invincible ended probably 2 or 3 years ago.
Wow.
With issue 144. But it was...
That guy was real busy.
Yeah.
Real busy.
And he does a bunch of stuff with his company, so he has... As a creative person, the life that you would want to have, which is that he's an executive producer on a TV show that's doing really well, that has a spinoff, that, I mean, his imprint of Image, I think it's called Skybound, is producing, he produces other stuff from, he kind of is a patron to other people who want to get certain comics done, but he also has like a card game that's part of it. Hmm. It's whatever he wants to do under that thing. He has the freedom to basically do and promote whatever he wants to do, because that Walking Dead money will probably keep him going for a long time. It's probably already put his kids through college.
I'm sure.
And yeah, it's kind of a place where, you know, he started out trying to get by writing comics and managed to do exactly the right thing at the right time in the right way.
Right.
And he's taking full advantage of that to have kind of the life that you want as a creative person, which is that money is no longer the motivating factor, getting back to Picard, behind the choices that you make, that you can do something that satisfies you on a creative level. And yeah, he's a businessman, but he gets to do exactly what he wants to do. And he wants to do something weird or something different. And it's kind of cool after the accomplishment of doing two more than a decade long series. I mean, Walking Dead, you say that's a 16-year story that he did.
It's crazy. And I think they are, and they're ending the TV series, right? And I think they have a movie that's queued up, I think, at some point.
Well, the TV show still going. Thing is, Andrew Lincoln, who played Rick Grimes, left the show shortly after. And the weird thing is, I don't think that they knew he was going to leave when they killed Carl off. Because Carl is the obvious, you know, replacement character.
Right.
But they did a time jump of like 6 years. Trying to figure out the Walking Dead TV show timeline versus Fear the Walking Dead is a fool's errand.
Sure.
It's still not as hard as X-Men, but it's not easy. And so at this point, not only has, you know, Andrew Lincoln and then I forget the name, Chandler Riggs, who played Carl, left, who would have been the obvious choice to take over as lead character. He's left the show because his character died. What's her name? Who plays Maggie on the show? She left, and her character sort of left between seasons. Michonne's actress, who is in Black Panther, she's leaving.
Sure.
Because obviously Black Panther is good money, and you don't need the TV show anymore. And after being on the show for like 7 years, I get going, okay, I did this. I want to do new things. I don't want to be just this one character. And she's got a great career ahead of her. And I think that once Michonne leaves, there are literally only two actors that have been on since season one. It's the actress who plays Carol, and then Norman Reedus, who plays Daryl Dixon,
yeah,
who was created for the show. So there is literally no original characters in the comic that are in this, because Carol's character in the comics died a long time ago, sure, during the prison storyline and became a very different person. And is, I think her character in the show is a lot better and is a lot more nuanced and cool. But Daryl was straight up created for the show.
Hmm.
So it's really interesting. When you lose that many, I'm kind of like, I think that there's a sense that we're kind of just figuring out where we're going to end this when all of these really popular characters have left. And I'm sorry, Norman Reedus is not the lead actor on your show.
No.
He's the Wolverine. He's not the, yeah, Cyclops. you don't make Wolverine the...
Norman Reedus could play Wolverine.
That would be interesting, but, you know, no, probably not.
Listen, I think the next actor to play Wolverine has to have just a knockdown killer Canadian accent. My vote is for the guy who, is his name Alexander Skarsgård? Is that the, I don't know if he's part of that family or if has the same last name.
Is that all one big Skarsgård clan?
I think it probably is.
I
who
don't
knows?
Know.
It's like the Wayanses over there. They're Swedish Wayanses, I think, is what they are. He plays, he was in Longshot. Did you see Longshot, the Seth Rogen?
No.
How was Charlize Theron? It was funny. It was good. It was syrupy and light and whatever, but Alexander Skarsgård plays the Canadian prime minister, who is he's Trudeau, obviously, to a certain extent, but he's just kind of like this really goofy, like, charm. He's not very charming. He's handsome and goofy, and he's completely ruled by his handlers. And they want to fix him up, but he has, even though he's a Swedish actor, he does like the perfect foppish Canadian accent. And so I was like, he could do it. He's a little tall to play.
You want to go all Strange Brew with,
yes,
Logan?
Yes.
The one
isn't Wolverine supposed to be very short, though?
He's like 5'3" in the comics.
Yeah. But maybe Alexander Skarsgård.
Speaking of movies about political campaigns, can I just, before we wrap this up, can I talk really quickly about a pet peeve I have that makes no sense, that in every movie about a presidential election, like a fictional one,
mm-hmm,
where you have fictional candidate versus fictional candidate, is electoral college maps that make no sense, where things are red and blue at seemingly random. And I'm like, that's not how that works.
That just must be like a fun thing that the people who do the graphics, like the on-screen graphics, have. They're just like, we'll make an extra state here, and that's what I would do.
But you just make up, it's like, oh, you know, the North and South Dakota are one thing. It's just Dakota. I do like alternate little things, the alternate history universe stuff. But right. But I mean, like in this one, Texas is blue and New York is red. And I'm like, right, what is going on here? It just, these things like that just make no sense most of the time, where you're like, what is, and it's not, it's like, if you look at a real electoral college map, these states tend to bunch up.
Right.
They don't bunch up in these ones. They're just like random. It's like they had a paint thing and they're like, okay, I'm just going to randomly pick things in the blue paint can, and I'm going to pick things in the red paint can. And it's like, whatever, Republicans won Hawaii, whatever. It's stuff like that that just, it's not like you don't have a bunch of past elections. You can just go, okay, make it look kind of like that, but make some changes. Because most of the time they look fairly similar.
I'm still going to chalk it up to someone in the art department was just having the time of their life.
You just like, whatever, fuck it. Because that happens all the time in these things.
I think I mentioned this, one of the Wolfenstein games, the new Wolfenstein games, where the plot is that Germany wins. And Germany takes over America and most of the rest of the world. And you just see a map of Europe that has, you know, basically has, I don't know, it's in blue or red or something where the Nazis are. And the only place that is not occupied by the Nazis is Scotland for some reason. And you're like, that's a great, I'm sure there's a great story and I hope they never tell it.
Yeah, yeah. The Romans stopped there too. So I get it.
Radio vs. the Martians is hosted by Mike Gillis and Casey Doran. This podcast is recorded in beautiful Valverde in Seattle, Washington. Our chief engineer is Casey Doran, and our editor is Mike Gillis. Our original theme music is written and performed by James Wetzel. Special thanks to Sam Mulvey, Rob Kelly, James Wetzel, Paul Rue, Tobiah Panshin, Scott Kramer, Kyle Hepworth, and Todd Maxfield Matsumoto. Please take the time to rate and review our show on iTunes and Stitcher, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And if you'd like to support the show financially, please consider becoming one of our Patreon subscribers. Even just $1 a month gives you access to exclusive episodes. And you can always find us online at radioversusthemartians.com.